James 2:21 through 2:24, the ninth talk in a series on James, was presented by Ron Julian on February 19, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
In chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, where James talks about faith and works, those of you who've been around here for a while have certainly heard me talk about this before. This section is famous for the seeming contradiction between Paul and James. In Romans 3:28, Paul says, "For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law." But in James 2:24, James says, "You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone." And as a young Christian, looking at those two verses was about as bad as it could get. I mean, the thought crossed my mind that I had gotten involved with something that had absolutely no consistency or coherence to it at all, and who knows how this is supposed to sort itself out. And of course, the problem is that Paul and James seem to be disagreeing about what has to be one of the most important questions we could ask. If the Christian faith has any truth to it at all, the issue that it confronts is, who is it that is justified before God? And how does that come about? And Paul and James seem to be disagreeing on that question. So part of the reason that those of you who have been around here for a while have heard me talk about this before is that this is one of the first questions that I confronted and wrestled with the Bible over. So I've been talking about it for as long as I've been talking about the Bible. But this is where we have come, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I want this morning, we're not going to go into 2:14. I have found that it is easier for me to talk about the beginning part of this section, 2:14 and following, if we first look at the example that James uses of the life of Abraham. So several verses later, James has this to say about Abraham and him being justified by works. And that's what I want to look at this morning, is I want to look at this story of Abraham and see what it is that James is saying there. And then the next time we come back, I will go back to 2:14 and we'll look at the whole section and see what he's doing. But today I just want to talk about Abraham and what James is doing with Abraham. And so I didn't actually write it down. Is it like verse 20 or 21? One of the striking things that we are going to find here is that when we're comparing Paul and James, both of them refer to the same verse. Not only do they seem to have something different to say about faith and works, but they both refer to the example of Abraham, and they both quote the same verse. Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Paul quotes that verse, James quotes that verse, and yet Paul uses it to argue that Abraham was justified by faith, and James uses it to argue that Abraham was justified by works. So I was wrong. It's even worse than what I said before. So what are we going to make of this? So this is the section I want to talk about this morning. I think it's verse 20 or maybe 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God." You see that a man is justified by works, and not by faith alone. Well, in order to understand James' point, we're going to need to explore some episodes in the life of Abraham. Because that's key. James has something specific that he's arguing from this event in Abraham's life. And in order to understand that argument, we're going to have to look at a few details. So I don't know if you want to follow with me. I'm going to be bouncing around Genesis a little bit, starting with Genesis 12. And I'm sort of selectively picking verses here to try to keep this tight. Now the Lord said to Abram, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And a little later on he says, to your descendants I will give this land. Okay, now this is a very important passage in the Bible, and we could talk a lot about the implications of what God is saying to Abraham. He says he's going to bless Abraham. He's going to bless all the families of the earth through Abraham. For our purposes here, though, the most important part of what he says is that his promises have something to do with Abraham having descendants. God is going to make Abraham a great nation. And he says that he's going to give the land to his descendants. Now, for these promises to come true, therefore, Abraham is going to have descendants. And right now, he has no kids, he is 75 years old, and his wife is barren. Various things happen in Abraham's life. The next incident we want to look at is in chapter 15 of Genesis, with verse 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. And Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Okay, so God says to Abraham, I am going to reward you greatly. And Abraham basically says to God, well, okay, I remember about all of this blessing and great nation and all that stuff you said, but you might not have noticed, but I don't have any kids. And since I don't have any kids, what are you going to do for me? I mean, what you promised, what I'm looking for is this blessing and the being a great nation and all of the stuff that you promised, but it doesn't seem to be happening. So God's response to him is to say, okay, no, I know that right now, technically speaking, this other guy would be your heir, but no, you are going to have an heir from your own body. You, Abraham, are going to father a child, and that child will be the beginning of a long line of descendants that will be, in part, a fulfillment of the promises that God had made to him. Abraham, in response to this, we are told, in one of the key statements in the Bible, that we are told that Abraham believed what God had told him about having a son and many descendants, and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. Paul describes this verse as Abraham being justified by faith, and that's exactly what it is. Here is Abraham responding to the promise that God has made to him with belief. I believe you. Yes, I'm an old man, and my wife is barren, but I believe you. Somehow or another, I am going to have descendants that come from my own body. And God counted it to him as righteousness. Abraham was right with God because he was the person who believed the things that God had promised him. And Paul says that we're in the same position. We have been made promises in the gospel, and we are right with God by believing the promises that we have been given. So we're in the same situation that Abraham is, Paul says. Now the important question for us is, at this point, does James disagree with Paul that verse is talking about Abraham being justified by faith? James quotes the verse, but he quotes it to defend the idea that Abraham is justified by works. So is James disagreeing with Paul? Is he understanding the sense of this verse differently? Well, I'm going to argue that he doesn't understand the sense of it differently, that he agrees with Paul that this is a description of Abraham being justified by faith. Of course it is. That's exactly what it says. I mean, that's literally what it says. So, of course, James believes that Abraham was justified by faith. But he has another point to make. In order for us to understand that point, though, we're going to have to go farther. Paul only refers to this episode in Genesis where Abraham believes this promise and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. But James is going to go on to another incident in Abraham's life to make his point. And in order to understand that, we're going to have to look at a few more things. But what do we know so far? We know that God has made a promise to Abraham that he's going to bless him, that he's going to make him a great nation, and now specifically, he has promised him that a child from his own body is going to be the one that is going to bring about these promises, at least the descendant part of the promises. That's what Abraham has believed, and that's why he was justified, because he believed that promise. Now, later in Abraham's life, you probably know the story, Sarah despaired of ever having a child. She was old and barren, and so she gives her handmaiden Hagar to Abraham, says, have a child with her, and then that'll be my child. You know, this will count for mine. And so at the end of chapter 16, going into chapter 17 of Genesis, 16:15, so Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham. For I will make you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come forth from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout your generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your descendants after you. And I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So, here we have God coming along and reaffirming to Abraham the promises that he had made before. I'm going to make you the father of many, and your descendants will be my people and inherit the land and all of that. In verse 15, then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, will a child be born to a man 100 years old? And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. But God said, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. Okay, so Abraham at this point has a child from his own body. His name is Ishmael, and his mother was Hagar, the handmaiden. God comes along and says, you're going to be the father of many, but your wife is going to be the mother of many. You're going to have a child through her. And Abraham laughs, which was not a polite thing to do to God, I don't think, but that's what he did. He laughed. He says, that doesn't sound very plausible to me. And he makes this comment then, may Ishmael live before you. And what he means, I think, in the context is pretty clear. Look, you promised me a son from my own body. I have one. let's go with him. Here he is. So, you know, father of many and all of that stuff, he's right here ready to go, so let's go with him. And God says, no, that's not what we're going to do. Your wife, Sarah, she'll be called Sarah now, and you are going to have a child with her. And it's going to be next year, and his name is going to be Isaac. So God has gotten very specific now in the promises that he's made to Abraham. I am going to make you a great nation, but it is through a child who's going to be born next year, and his name is Isaac. That's the child through whom my promises are. Now, Isaac is born, funny thing. And afterwards, we come to a profoundly important event. If you look at the story in the Bible as describing the genuine interaction of God with humanity, the God who is really there and with whom we have to do, then this story here is one of the truly important things that ever happened in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned. In chapter 22. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So probably you know this story. God asks Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, give him to take him to the top of a mountain and kill him as an offering to God. And he goes to do that in obedience. He does what God asks, only God stops him just before he's about to kill him and says, now I know that you would obey me, and he provides a ram for the sacrifice instead. Now, our concern, there are a lot of things we could talk about in this story, but the thing that we want to talk about here is the concept of God testing Abraham. What is the nature of this test? Because this is central to the argument that James is making. And really, we have to understand the nature of Abraham's test in order to understand the nature of our own tests that we face in life. I've been very deliberately pointing out the circumstances that led up to this event because they provide for us the context to understand what it is that was being tested here. God had made very specific promises to Abraham. He was going to make him a great nation through the child Isaac, born from Abraham's body and Sarah's body at a particular time in a particular year. There's no question about it. This kid, Isaac, is the child of promise. God has made it very clear. I am going to do this thing through this child. And now God, who had promised Isaac these incredible promises, I mean, had promised Abraham these incredible promises through Isaac, was saying, give him back. I want you to kill him and give him back to me, in essence. The question that Abraham confronted, I would argue, is this. Do I still believe the promises of God? God has told me that Isaac will live and will found a great nation. Do I believe him or not? It's not the question, should I obey God and kill my kid? But rather, the God who promised me that Isaac will live is asking me to take his life. Hebrews chapter 11, I think, is very helpful in understanding this stuff. It explains exactly what Abraham was thinking in this circumstance. It says in Hebrews 11:17, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendant shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. So he's telling us here, Abraham received the promises. Before he was asked to offer Isaac, he had been told that Isaac was the one through whom he would have descendants and all the promises of God would be fulfilled. So the author of Hebrews is saying to us here, that's the nature of the test. Abraham has heard the promises. Through Isaac your descendants will be called. He knows that Isaac is the one, and yet now he's being asked to kill him. So the test really is whether Abraham believed that God would fulfill the promises he had made. The author of Hebrews says it was by faith that Abraham responded in this way, and then he explains explicitly how he had faith. He had heard the promise that Isaac would be the one, and so he was willing to do this because he believed that God would keep his promise. It must be the case, he thought, that God would raise Isaac again. God would have to, because he promised that Isaac would live, have children, and found a nation. So the author of Hebrews is making a very explicit claim for what was in Abraham's mind and what was being tested. It was not, will you descend to the depths of killing your own kid? It is, will you follow me? Will you obey me and continue to believe that I will keep the promises that I made? So Abraham in this circumstance is being asked to decide whether he really believes that God will keep the promises that he had made earlier. That's the circumstance. That's what the test is. Okay. Having said all that, then, we're in a position to understand what James says in the section that we're looking at. And let me read it to you again. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Okay. So, now, what I'm about to argue seems very clear to me in the light of all of the things that we have looked at, but I should probably warn you that the way of understanding this passage that I'm about to articulate seems to be fairly rare. In my studies that I've been doing recently, I had the opportunity, I decided, it was a historical class, I was taking church history stuff, and I decided to kind of go and look at the arguments that various reformers and people in Reformed theology have made concerning this passage. How do they understand what it is that's happening here? Since Reformed theology, following Calvin and influenced by Luther, very much an emphasis on justification by faith, how did all those guys understand what James was doing here? So I kind of went and looked around to see what they did. And it surprised me that everybody pretty much seemed to take it the way that I don't take it. So if that bothers you, you know, I just wanted to warn you up front that, you know, Calvin and Luther was all over the map on this, and later on Jonathan Edwards and all those guys, they don't take this the way I do. They take it differently. But I did find one guy, Melanchthon, who, I mean, if it means anything to you, Melanchthon agrees with me on this, so I thought that was kind of cool. Me and Melanchthon, we're like that. Okay, so let me describe to you what I think is going on here then. First of all, does James believe that Abraham was justified by faith? Yes, he does. His whole argument depends on it. If you notice what he's doing, he's saying that, look, it says he was justified by faith back when he heard the promise, before Isaac was even born. He believed it, and he was justified by faith. That's what happened back in the past. What he did in offering up Isaac, he says, fulfills that. And the faith that he had back there is working with what he did later on. So the kind of argument that he wants to make here is there is a connection between the fact that he was justified by faith back here and that he acted in faith over here. That's the nature of the argument that he's going to make. But he's not disagreeing that Abraham was justified by faith. In fact, his argument falls apart if that verse isn't there saying that Abraham was justified by faith. Okay, so My first point would be Paul and James both agree that Genesis says that Abraham was justified by faith before Isaac was born because he believed God's promise. Where the problem comes in is this word works. And this is where I tend to disagree with the reformers that I was reading. What they want to do is put the difference between Paul and James on the word justify. That James means something different by being justified by works than Paul meant by being justified by faith. Paul's talking about being right with God. James is just talking about showing evidence, justified in the sense that I've shown some proof that I'm a believer, which is not a bad idea. That's very much related to what's going on here. But I'm convinced that the key place of difference is in the word works, that Paul and James have two very different things in mind when they're talking about works. Paul is talking to legalists, to those who think that they are right with God because they keep the law. And so for Paul, he's speaking against works of the law, being justified by works of the law. And he has in mind two different kinds of things, I think. First of all, I'm not justified by ritual observance. It is not enough to eat kosher and be circumcised and that sort of thing in order to be right with God. But more importantly, he's arguing that we are all sinners, such that I cannot be right with God on the basis of my obedience to God's moral law. All of us are condemned by the law of God. That none of us can stand before God and say, give me what I deserve, and expect to find life. That's Paul's argument. So I can't be justified by works of the law in either the sense that I can't be justified by eating kosher, nor can I be justified by obeying the law and expect to win God's approval through that, even the moral requirements of the law, because I can't do it. That's Paul's argument. James, though, is dealing with a very different problem here. He's writing to people who say they are believers, but who live as if the gospel is not true. When he looks at what's happening out in the churches, he sees behavior and attitudes that are absolutely in contradiction with the implications of the gospel that they say they have believed. So when James is talking about works, all he means is stuff that you do. He's not talking about ritual works of the law, and he's not talking about justifying myself through perfect obedience to God's moral law either. He's just talking about doing stuff. Either you do stuff or you don't in relationship to your faith. That's the issue that he's addressing here. And that, in fact, is a typical meaning of the word works. We have come to think of works in the kind of technical sense that I was referring to that Paul uses, but the word work is just, in the common language, is talking about a deed, an action, something that you do. James sees a connection between the faith, which is described as justifying Abraham in Genesis 15, and the work that he does of offering up Isaac in Genesis 22. Faith was working with his works. Why did he do the work of offering Isaac? Why did he do it? Why did he go to kill Isaac? Because he had faith, because he believed the promises that God had made. And that's exactly the point that the author of Hebrews makes. Abraham offered up Isaac because he believed the promise that Isaac would be the one who founded the descendants of Abraham. Hebrews says, by faith, Abraham offered up Isaac, and James says, faith was working with Abraham's works. That is, because he believed the promises that he had been given, he acted the way he did. He did what God asked him to do because he believed what God had promised. Concerning Isaac, Isaac is going to live. I don't care if I have to kill him, God has promised that he will live. And so, he will. He is going to found this nation because God said so. James says that Abraham's faith was perfected as a result of the works, which is a very important concept. And we've seen the roots of this in the earlier things in James that we have been looking at. It is perfected. It is made complete. It is brought to maturity. it has become all that it has meant to be. To believe something, to hear something and believe it, that's a significant thing to do. But when it's a profound truth that I'm believing that is hard to swallow and has a big impact on my life, there's a difference between hearing it and believing it and having that be an internal reality that hasn't yet really affected anything about the way I do things, versus actually now in the midst of my life having to act on that belief, to think about it and say, oh yeah, that's true, so I really ought to do this here instead of the way I would usually have done it, because now I believe something different. That's where the perfecting comes in. Faith matures when it has moved from an internal reality, it's there, but it hasn't yet really worked itself out into my life. It matures in action. It matures when I have to act on it. That's what James is saying. For Abraham, in Genesis 15, he believed it. He was justified before God. The passage doesn't say someday Abraham will be justified before God when he offers up Isaac on the altar. He was justified before God because he was a person of faith. But it was an immature faith. It was a faith that was still basically, okay, I'll buy that, and now let's move on and do other stuff. When he was asked to offer up Isaac, he had to confront the question directly. God is the one who made this promise. Do I still believe it? And in having to act on it, faith matured. It came into its own. It became fully what it's supposed to be. Along very similar lines, James says that when Abraham offered up Isaac, that fulfilled the passage that said that Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Now, this is a little bit tricky because we think of, if something fulfills a passage, we think of typically that the earlier passage was a prophecy, a prediction for the future, and then this fulfilled it. You know, the prophet said that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem. And then when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, that fulfilled what the prophets had said about that. That's how we typically think about it. But this is a little bit different. It's very similar to the idea of perfected. The idea of fulfilled is it has filled up. We have implicit in the statement about Abraham, he is a person of faith. He has believed this and he has been justified because he believes it. But the faith that is spoken about him, that it says he has and that is in his heart in Genesis 15, is fulfilled. We see the fulfillment of that statement when Abraham actually acts as a person of faith. He acts on what he believes and his life then reflects what it is that he had believed earlier. So in that sense, the offering of Isaac is a kind of fulfillment of the passage that says he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. As it turns out, he really does believe God. We see that he is in fact the sort of person that would be in the right with God. And if Genesis 15 had been followed by passage after passage where Abraham, God asked him to do stuff and says, and Abraham responds, no way, who can trust you? That statement about he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness all of a sudden has kind of been called into question. Wait a minute, what kind of guy is this Abraham? But in fact, what we see is congruence between his claim to faith in 15 and the way he acted in 22. Okay, well, there's a lot that could be said about all of those things, but I think now that I've said enough so that we're in a position to understand what James means when he says, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. To James, faith alone is a kind of an empty sort of faith, a claim to belief that never actually manifests itself in anything that you do or think. It's I believe that, and then you go on and act as if that were not true. James is writing to people who are living in such a way that everything they stand for and everything they approve of and are pursuing is in contradiction to the implications of the gospel that they say they believe. So they've said they believe it, but in fact, their lives don't look anything like that they actually in fact believe it. And in this section, James is asking the question, can you be saved by a faith that never shows itself? Can you be saved by a faith that is so invisible that you could never tell by anything that I ever do that I actually believe this stuff? And that's his point. Not that anything other than faith is a necessity for salvation, but that faith is a life-changing event. Look at the life of Abraham. Yes, he was justified by faith when he heard the promise before Isaac was born, but how did he live? Well, he lived as a sinner. We see many sinful attitudes on Abraham's part along the way. He doesn't do everything perfectly. But when push came to shove and he had to act on whether he actually believed the promise that God had made, he did, because he did in fact believe it. James' conclusion that Abraham was justified by works then is a shorthand statement of his whole argument. Abraham was justified by a faith in Genesis 15, which came to fruition and showed itself in action in works in 22. So his argument is that Abraham was justified by a real faith, not a bogus faith, but a real one. And how do I know it's real? Because ultimately you saw it in his life. So, probably most of us have mixed feelings about all of this stuff about works that James is talking about. On the one hand, once you see the point that he's making, it's a very reasonable point. I mean, this is not a controversial sort of thing to say in one sense. When people change their fundamental beliefs, their actions change along with it. I mean, that's just the way it works. We have the saying, actions speak louder than words, which reflects our common sense understanding that that's true. That ultimately, I see, you know, you can keep saying, oh yeah, I like you, oh yeah, I like you, but every time you have any opportunity to be kind or gracious to me, you stop having much meaning to it. And we all recognize that that's the case, that, you know, sooner or later, the way a person behaves is going to tell you where they're coming from. So, James' point is that real faith changes the way you live. And that shouldn't be a controversial idea. I mean, yeah, of course. What else would we expect? But on the other hand, the idea that our works, our actions, somehow are supposed to reflect our faith, and in fact our actions then are a kind of indicator of whether we are in fact right with God, that's a terrifying idea. If we are honest with ourselves, our actions reveal terrible things about us. The two great commandments are to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And yet, our actions often show that we fall short of that in many ways. If you look at my life, you will find many instances of me not loving God as I should and not loving my neighbor as I should. As myself? Give me a break. I mean, we're talking about me here. I mean, if I can be nice to you and not have it be a problem for me, that sounds great, sure. So let me know how it turns out. But I mean, all of us recognize that even though we know we don't belong at the center of the universe, we have a hard time removing ourselves from that spot. We live as if that's the spot that we naturally belong to. So to think about my actions as an indicator of what sort of person I am is a terrifying idea, because my actions demonstrate that I'm not at all the sort of person that I ought to be. So this is not easy stuff to deal with. This is very personally challenging, I think. And in my own life, it has been very challenging. So let's put this in perspective, though, just with a few comments. I want to be clear, first of all, about James' fundamental idea. This just carries through with what we've been seeing from the beginning of the letter. He is talking about the perfecting of faith through trials. He is talking about circumstances that God takes me through that test me, that try me, and in the process ultimately perfect my faith, mature my faith by bringing it out into the open in the way I live. Why does faith need perfecting? Well, first of all, faith starts out as an invisible sort of reality. It is a decision I have made inside that I now believe that where I didn't used to. So it's hard to see. Faith is also in conflict with a whole set of beliefs and habits that we have developed from our faulty way of looking at the world. I may have embraced a new way of looking at life. I have a new belief about who God is and who I am, but I have a whole set of attitudes and beliefs that are not consistent with that. And there is conflict between my new beliefs and the things that I have always thought and the things that I naturally tend to do. And then, let's face it, faith is in conflict with my essential sinfulness. I am still a selfish person, and the implications of my faith call me to look at my life in a way that is difficult and unpleasant to do. If I could avoid looking at it, I would rather do that. Well, God puts us in situations where our faith and our foolishness must battle it out. If we had our choice, we would rather not confront the issue. At least, this has been my experience. I think that as I look at my life, the difficulties in my life have forced me to deal with issues that I would have been quite happy to leave alone. I could have been happier. I could have had a lot less suffering in my life if I could have just lived with that my faith is over here and the way I just want to do things is over here and we can just keep them separate and they don't have to mingle. And it's not that I would have ever argued that's the way I want to live, but that's the way I wanted to live if I could. Well, I think that's true for all of us. We don't want to make those choices. We would like to be believers and yet drift along living the way we've always lived. Except for the obvious things, you know, if we were a drug addict, you think, oh, you know, that's not going to get me anywhere. I'll give up that stuff. And, you know, give up the big stuff. But a fundamental change of perspective on my place in the universe, if I could avoid that, I would be willing to do that. Well, that's why God sends us trials, to wake us up, to force the issues of faith out into the open so that we have to deal with them. This process cannot be counterfeited. We can't just go out and start doing good works and somehow prove that we're believers. You know, good works, in a way, they're easy to come by. Let's have a huge disaster hit Eugene. Most of the people in Eugene will gather together. They'll start bringing people into their homes and here, let me give you clothes. And, you know, everybody will rally together and help each other and everybody will talk about what a wonderful experience it was, how everybody pulled together. It doesn't mean that everybody in Eugene suddenly turned into a Christian because of an earthquake or something like that. It just means we are made in the image of God. We understand the value of compassion and those sorts of things, and people tend to pull together when there are difficulties. So you'd see all kinds of good works in that situation, but that's not really the issue. The issue is that the gospel is a story that has implications for the way we look at the world. The gospel tells us who we are. It tells us about our true problems. It tells us the true solutions to those problems. It tells us who God is and how He has provided for us. It gives us an entirely different picture of things. The works that James is talking about are those places where the implications of that story confront me in real life. They are actions that are consistent with the gospel, not just with a vague sort of benevolence for everyone, but specifically with the story that God is telling us. He's already shown us one way that that's true. He's going to show us others. But we've seen how the issue of money is one of those places where it can be. They have rich people coming into their assembly, and they're treating them well because they're hoping to get something from them. Poor believers, they ignore because they have nothing to offer. And James is saying, well, but if it's true that all the riches of this world are going to be gone, and only those people who have put their trust in Christ are going to, in fact, inherit eternal life, a blessed existence forever in the kingdom of God, then who's really rich here? Why is it that you think that the rich guy is rich when he can't keep any of it, and the poor believer is, in fact, going to inherit everything? Why do you think that the rich guy is rich? So there's a place where they're actually having to confront the implications of the gospel that they say they believe. Let me show you another one from the Bible. Let's bring Paul into this. Because I would argue that Paul, when we look at his teaching, he believes the same thing. That the implications of the gospel, we're going to confront them in the way that we live. And let me give you as an example what we see in the book of Galatians. The book of Galatians is written concerning the problem of the Judaizers, Jewish Christians. They were Pharisees who had become believers in Jesus as the Messiah. But they also believed that you, in order to be right with God, you had to be a believer in Jesus as the Messiah, but you also had to keep the Jewish law. And that, in fact, if you weren't keeping the law, then you were disobedient to God and God would not accept you. They would say, yes, Jesus is the Christ, but don't think that God will accept you just because you believe that. You have to earn your salvation by keeping the law. We Judaizers keep the law, and God likes us. If God is going to like you, you have to be law keepers as we are. In essence, I mean, that's what it comes down to. And the Judaizers, therefore, were insisting to the Galatians. They were coming along and saying, forget about what Paul's saying. If you are not circumcised, then you will not be saved. That is, if you don't become Jewish and keep the Jewish law, you will not be saved. Well, what does Paul say to the Galatians? In a very striking statement, he says, in response to what they've been hearing, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Well, being circumcised is a work. It is an action. It is something that a person might choose to do. But in this context, Paul sees that action as betraying what they actually believe. Why would they do the action of getting circumcised? It is because they have bought this story that the Judaizers are selling them, that they can make themselves right with God by obeying the Mosaic law, that God's acceptance of them is dependent on their keeping this law. And so they are buying this self-righteous picture. I'm not a sinner who is totally justified on the basis of what Christ did on the cross without my in any way being able to demonstrate my worthiness of that salvation. No, they're buying this picture from the Judaizers that they are essentially good law keepers who have earned God's blessing. Yes, Jesus is the Messiah, but don't think he's going to save somebody who isn't keeping the law like I am. Now, Paul doesn't think that the action of circumcision is itself bad, but in this case, the action shows the inner belief. Paul wants them to stand up to the Judaizers and say, no, God is accepting me because of my faith, not because I keep the law. As, for instance, Titus did when he was with Paul. They all stood up and said to the Judaizers, no, he is not going to respond to this pressure to be circumcised because that is to compromise the gospel. If they don't get circumcised, if they choose not to do that, their action would show that they're understanding what the gospel is all about. If they do get circumcised, their action shows that they don't really understand or believe the true gospel. Now, notice that once again, the issue is not good works in the classic sense. If I want to improve myself, I don't make a list of the good works that I ought to do today. Feed the poor, be faithful to my wife, don't get circumcised. I mean, that's not how it works. But in this context, that particular action spoke volumes about where they were coming from inside. And so Paul could say, in essence, if you do that, Christ will be of no benefit to you. That is, you're not really looking to the Christ that I know for salvation apart from your works. You're believing in some different Christ who's going to save you because you kept the law. So Paul and James are exactly on the same page. Ultimately, you're going to confront the question of whether you believe the gospel in its various implications in the circumstances of life that God takes you through. What James is saying is not a contradiction of the gospel of grace, as I understand it. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that the testing of our faith is in fact the grace of God at work in our lives. We don't really want to be fools our entire lives. If you stop and think about it, as painful as it is, the ignorance and foolishness that has trapped and engulfed my life is not my friend. I want to see God more clearly. I want to see myself more clearly. I want to know what's really going on. Well, God tested Abraham, forcing him to decide whether he really believed God's promises concerning Isaac, and he was a different man after he had gone through it. God was testing James' readers, forcing them to decide, who is my true benefactor, a rich man or God? God tested the Galatians, forcing them to decide, what is going to save me, my obedience to the law or faith in the salvation Christ offered? And God is going to test us. This is what he does. He will not let faith hide in our hearts. He forces us to live it out. But in the process, we learn. We learn that we are people of faith, and we come to understand better what life is about. So this is a painful process, but it is also God's greatest gift to us on this side of heaven. God has greater things in store for us, ultimately. But now, in this world, in its fallen and very incomplete state, one of the greatest things that God can do for us is to take us through trials so that we can come to know what's really going on. Okay, so I have any questions or comments? We have one up here and then one back there.
So Ron, is the concept that James is referring to that works is being or faith is being perfected through our works in a general sense,
mm-hmm.
Is that the same concept that Paul refers to in Galatians 5 as walking by the Spirit, just in different terms based on the situation, or are those two separate concepts? And we can talk about it afterwards if you want to.
Okay. Well, that's a very difficult passage in Galatians. I think there are two kinds of issues there that are being talked about,
right.
And one of them is, I think very close to what James is talking about here. I mean, Paul is partly talking about the thing that has nothing to do with me. It is the work of the Spirit in accomplishing in me what I cannot accomplish myself in my flesh. So this is the power of God actually working to transform me and to sanctify me and all of that kind of stuff. So that part of his discussion of the Spirit, I think, is not necessarily related to what James is talking about here, but towards the end of that section, he talks about, literally, it's sort of lining up with the Spirit, and what he's talking about there is we have this choice. What he's saying is, if the gospel is in fact what I'm saying it is, if we have either those who are condemned to nothing but their own flesh and who can bring forth nothing but death and evil, ultimately, and then those in whom the Spirit is leading to these fruits of love and goodness and that sort of thing, then how should I live? What should I do then? I should then try to live in such a way that I am lining up with these things that I know the Spirit is about bringing in my life. So Yeah, so that part of it, he's talking about living in a way that's consistent with my picture of what it is that God has promised in the gospel. So yeah, that part I think is very similar. So does that answer your question? Okay.
So it seems to me with the works issue, the Judaizers were almost trying to procure God's favor by feeling they had to do this to almost earn salvation. I mean, because within myself, there's times that, yeah, okay, I feel like doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other times I don't feel like doing the right thing,
mm-hmm.
but I need to choose to do the right thing, even though I don't feel that way. Is that, in terms of, is that what you're kind of saying, that I'll pick kind of this because I know that's what God calls me to do?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I am caught in that spot where I definitely feel I know what I want to do is this thing, but, you know, I recognize that what I ought to do is, you know, there's something that I want to do, but there's somebody who needs something from me, and I don't really feel like doing it, but that's what I ought to do, let's say, something along those lines. I've made this comment before, but I think there is a good hypocrisy and a bad hypocrisy. And there is a kind of good hypocrisy in my recognizing, you know, my desires in this case are not, I have them, but they don't reflect what I want to be about, what I believe and what I value. So I'm fighting myself. It's what I believe is in conflict with my selfish desires. That battle, there's a certain hypocrisy there because I am fighting to do something that I don't want to do. But that's a good battle to be happening because I'm confronting the question of, well, but yeah, but what is it that I want to be about? What do I believe? Now, there are other kinds of hypocrisy, though, where the reason that I do the thing ultimately against what it is that I'm actually about is it doesn't is not a good reason. Maybe I'm a hypocrite in that I don't really want to do it on the one hand, but I think that everybody's really going to admire me for having done this great thing. And so, yeah, now the motives that have led me to do the thing that I didn't want to do don't really reflect on my faith. They reflect on something else. You know, like Jesus said, you have your reward in full. You were looking for the applause of the crowd and you got it. So what's key here is that what I'm confronting in these choices are the issues of my faith, that I believe that I'm a sinner, so I'm going to admit it and apologize to someone, or I have a desire to be wealthy, but I'm struggling with it, but I'm not going to take this road because that's, even though it might get me wealthier, it's not in keeping with my values and what I believe to be true, and all of those kinds of things. It's in those struggles that I'm actually learning and growing a lot. So, yeah, that it can be all kinds of different issues. I mean, I think each one of us could describe circumstances that we have faced that have pushed us in a particular way to confront some part of the gospel story, either the part that says I'm a sinner, the part that says I can't earn my salvation with God, the part that says God has promised me something greater than what this world can give me. I mean, all of those different things are going to be tested as I face them.
It seems like the culture of Christianity almost says that what works will just flow out of your faith, and I think that's true at times. But I think that's not true at times. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, let's take that word flow. Were Abraham's works flowing out of his faith at that spot? I said they were flowing. I'll bet they were flowing really slow. Because I just seriously doubt that Abraham jumped up and said, hey, sounds good to me. I believe. I mean, I'm sure he agonized over the decision. What am I going to do here? They arose from his faith. But they were actually, I would bet, the process of a great struggle. And the process of our faith being tested, we see examples of how messy it can be in the Bible. And every Christian I've ever talked to who's been through these sorts of experiences recognizes how messy it can be. I'm struggling in the midst of this. Nothing flowing here. This is just an ultimately coming to the place where I recognize, no, this is what I want to be about. George?
Ron, one of my favorite persons in the Bible concerning lifestyle is the thief on the cross. His lifestyle really gets to me. Insofar as that he did the one thing I believe James is talking about, and that's to do the work of faith, which is to believe. Now, this is where I agree that Paul and James are together because they're both Christocentric. We have two faiths, and I'm surprised some of the Greek students hadn't brought this out, but you know, part of the genius of the Greek language is the definite article. It comes from the demonstrative pronouns this and that, and then, of course, these and those. In particular, the gift faith rendered with the definite article becomes a special faith outside of ourselves, something that only God can give. I don't think we're not born with the kind of faith that James is talking about. It's a gift of faith that God gives, and along with that faith comes the works of faith, that is, justification by faith in the righteousness of Christ alone. And if you notice, every example that is given in the Hall of Fame of those who participated in the Old Testament that I believe Paul, when he wrote Hebrews, wrote about in the 11th chapter, shows that all of them refer to those specific acts that God reminds us that point to the gospel, the one and only Son. You know, the writer to Hebrews starts out with the first word is God. And if you notice in Genesis, the first word is God in the beginning. Well, you have the prepositions there, of course, and you render the Hebrew. But everything revolves around God, which the Yahweh, of course, as the mystery is revealed in the New Testament, that it is Christ in us, the hope of glory, namely Jesus is our Yahweh. So we see Jesus, we see God, and we see him with words, that the tapestry of words is constructed so that it revolves around the question, are you going to believe or are you not going to believe? So if we get into lifestyle and this kind of thing along the lines of the flesh, which is where the readers of James's letter tend to be, and this is what James is saying, then, of course, we have to set up an arbitrary standard by saying, well, you're justified by faith because you participate in this particular activity. The activity always revolves around who Jesus is, and the focus is on who he is and what he has done and not what we have to do. And James is a collaborator with Paul on this. You see, the problem with Melanchthon in the Reformation is that he compromised with the Reformers, and as a result, the Reformation moved to, fortunately for us, England, but it didn't stay with Germany. So we have to get away from that kind of pietism so that we not trespass into waters that detract us from the main person of the gospel, namely Jesus Christ.
Okay, George. I don't know. I mean, there are a number of things you said that I would agree with, I think. You and I don't look at definite articles the same way, I can tell that. And I'm not sure what you mean. We don't have time to pursue it now, but when you say the work is believing in Jesus, if I'm following what you're saying, I think we do have a disagreement there, because I think James is talking about the work being the like Abraham's going to offer up Isaac. It is something that I do that is a result of that faith. It is the work is not the believing, it is the...
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
No,
we do have to stop, though.
You see, the doing on the basis of faith is a picture of his ultimately believing in the sacrificial act of which he experienced. It was the aha, now I see. Just like Job had that same experience. He went through the trial and suffering, and the focus is not ultimately is on what Job saw as a result. He said, aha, I'm really not righteous in and of myself. And you see, when we get into focusing on what we have to do instead of what God has done for us, then what we've done is put the cart before the horse.
Okay, I'm having trouble following you, but that may be the place we disagree. I can't tell. If you mean one thing by that, maybe I could agree with what you're saying, and if you mean another thing by it, I don't. And I don't think we have time to explore it now, but certainly, let me just say in conclusion, I don't in any way want to suggest that James is suggesting that there are some things we need to go out and do to establish that we're believers. But I do think that James is saying that the things that I do in life ultimately show what I believe. And
who's going to be there to evaluate? In other words, can I tell by your life, Ron, that you're justified by faith in the righteousness of Christ alone?
I don't think that James, in writing his letter, he's not suggesting that he knows whether the people that he's writing to ultimately have that faith or not. But he is saying that God takes us through those kinds of trials that show ultimately that that work of faith is in fact going on in us or not. I don't think that anywhere they're recommending that it is my job to evaluate where you are and say you're not a believer, but that God evaluates where we are by taking us through trials and showing us ultimately what we're about. I think that's absolutely the case. And who's going to judge ultimately, of course, is God. So we got to stop. Thank you.